Welcome on to another playoff edition of the Dunks on Basketball podcast. Got Golden State and Portland game five today, as well as Toronto and Miami game five as well. We're sponsored today by Betterment Automated Investing. You can find out more about them at betterment.com/capspace. Joining me to talk these games five, Danny LaRue.
That was an interesting night of basketball. I mean, the result was, I guess you could say it kind of turned out as expected, but at the same point, it was interesting all the same.
Yeah, we'll start with Golden State and Portland. Golden State really needed this one, and Portland, I thought, earned their respect. Certainly had a very good series, and the 4-1 outcome was probably not indicative, frankly, of how well they played. Their offense was very difficult for Golden State to stop at times, and they even played better defensively than you might have hoped, despite the fact that they have some kind of flaws on their roster, which we'll talk about today and then tomorrow when we do their offseason preview. But yeah, I mean, the biggest thing to me was that Golden State was able to close this out, despite the fact that really for the first time in a while, you know, they just do not look healthy at all.
And not only do they not look healthy, but I don't think they executed particularly well on defense in this game, or really other than those two quarters, the first quarter of game one and the fourth quarter of game two. They didn't really have those kind of stretches. I mean, Curry went off in overtime, of course, in game four, but the Warriors didn't look like the Warriors to me that much of the series.
I thought their defense in the second half of game four and the overtime got there. And that Portland was still quite good as well. And I thought that a lot of their problems, too, has been with that bench unit. You know, Steph was plus 10 in this game. And when Spates would come in, they just were getting worked at the start of the second and fourth quarters pretty much every game. And the one that they weren't was when Steph was in game four. But, I mean, I think we'll talk about the health situation first. First of all, how did Steph look to you today?
He didn't look all the way back. It was another game where he looked a lot worse early than he did late. I don't know if that's a part of this process. But early on, he definitely looked off.
Yeah, I thought so. Steve Kerr acknowledged after the game that he was not 100%. I think that he just doesn't have his normal pop still on his drives. You know, he's a great shooter. He's a very intelligent player. He's in great shape. You know, they weren't really running him hard off the ball on those screens as much, which is surprising. You'd think they maybe would do more of that rather than put the ball in his hands to dribble. But when he was going to the basket, he was not finishing with the same abandon that he normally does. Now, against this team, it didn't matter as much, right? Like, you know, someone like Plumlee, he's able to sort of be more in control and then still stop and fake him out and get a pretty decent shot. And then, you know, just some of the windows, those late threes that he had over Davis and Aminu, there was just, he created no separation whatsoever and still was just able to get it off so quickly and it went in. I mean, just those, the last one that he hit over Aminu that iced the game with like 25 seconds left to put him up five. Like I just put my head down on the desk in front of me. Like I just couldn't believe it. Like it was one of, even in a season of ridiculous shots, it was like beyond ridiculous.
Yeah, it was really incredible. And the dribble moves that led up to it were awesome. And, you know, he had a couple of those real Steph Curry moments in this game. Of course, he had some of those in game four as well. And he had 11 assists, which is, I think, notable as well. And he played pretty well, but it wasn't though at the same point, it didn't look like he was all the way back. He wasn't dominant start to finish like he is so often during the regular season.
And I think the 11 assists was somewhat indicative of the fact that he was looking for the pass a little bit more on some of those drives, and also just the fact that Klay Thompson was absolutely on fire. And we'll get to his incredible night. But Draymond Green also, really for one of the first times that I can remember, got injured. His mom actually tweeted that he had tweaked his ankle in the previous game. He went full court and got fouled while shooting a layup. You couldn't really see on the replay anything untoward that happened, but you know, then he was just limping afterwards. He had to go back to the locker room, get retaped, and then he clearly wasn't himself after that on either end, I felt.
Yeah, he wasn't getting the explosion and lift offensively because he had one drive and he was going to try to finish over, I think it was over at Davis, and he just couldn't get there. And then defensively, he was, you know, he was a little bit off. And I think he could be the guy, depending on what happens with Bogut, he could be the guy who could benefit the most from the extra time off.
Yeah, there was also a play late where he threw a pass to the corner instead of taking what Kerr thought was a dunk. You know, Kerr even acknowledged that he, you know, was kind of struggling a little bit too. So the fact that the Warriors were able to still pull this out anyway was thanks to Klay Thompson. Thompson, 13 out of 17, 6 of 9 on threes, many of them very, very difficult looks. And, you know, we talk about the insane shots that Curry hits, but Thompson hits shots that nobody else in the league could be hitting. I mean, Klay Thompson is basically, you know, I know that, like, Klay doesn't get to the line as much as he does, but, like, Klay is probably as good as Reggie Miller in his prime at this point, I would say.
Definitely off the ball. I think on the ball, Reggie.
And he's a much better defensive player.
Yeah, Reggie had more craft on ball, but Klay's defense is a lot better. And, I mean, he had a real tough assignment for most of the series and did a solid job of it.
Yeah, and just overall for him to be 13 out of 17 on the type of shots that he takes. I mean, and he's able to mix in a few on cuts and stuff, but I mean, probably four or five of his threes were basically shots that only he and Curry are going to take regularly, both because, and maybe J.R. Smith can take shots that are that hard, but J.R. Smith doesn't set them up by moving off the ball the way that Curry and Thompson can. And, you know, just a quick drive, throw it to a big, and then you're immediately sprinting back out to the three-point line and hitting some of these crazy shots. So Seth and I had a little bit of a tweet exchange that we probably didn't get a chance to finish, but is Klay Thompson the MVP of the playoffs so far to you? I think he might actually be mine.
Yeah, I think he's off the top of my head, I think so. He was such an important part of this run. I'll give you his point total and shot totals from just this series when Curry was out the entire time until game four. Game one, 37 points on 28 field goal attempts. Game two, 27 points on 20 field goal attempts. Game three, 35 points on 28, then 23 on 18 and 33 on 17 tonight. And he's not adding too much of that at the free throw line because he just doesn't take many free throws.
Yeah, and also the fact that, you know, in the first round he was unstoppable also against, you know, what was somewhat of a limited Houston team, obviously, at least in terms of their effort level.
And he guarded Lillard.
He guarded Lillard the whole game. You know, he had the key stop of this game when the one time that Portland actually was within range to tie it late, he forced Lillard into an impossible fadeaway. That team actually came closer to hitting than you might have expected. But, you know, he did a great job guarding him down the stretch in game four. He did a pretty nice job overall on Harden. He was their best defender on Harden. And he's not playing quite as many minutes as some of these other guys. I think part of the reason that Kerr keeps his minutes, you know, in the 36, 37 minutes a game range is because he has to also guard the other team's best player in these two series. But yeah, I think he's great. I mean, who would be some of the other candidates for MVP of the playoffs? I mean, Paul George was probably MVP of round one, but he's been out now, so he's kind of ineligible. And LeBron and Kawhi would be the other two that come to mind for me.
Yeah, DeMar DeRozan.
Hey, DeMar had 34 points tonight. We will get to his night. Yeah, and maybe if the Spurs had won the last game, you might say it was Kawhi even, you know, but, you know, although he hasn't really, I don't think Kawhi, aside from the steals, has been, like, that amazing, partially because they haven't put him on Durant and said, hey, lock down Durant.
Yeah, Kawhi's been more about moments rather than consistent impact, yeah. But his moments have been awesome. I mean, that dunk on Steven Adams was incredible, the backhanded steal, like, he's had some of those definitive plays in a very different way than Curry's are, but he's...
Well, he's also has, like, you know, a 61 true shooting percentage, yeah. But Klay, 64 true shooting percentage for the playoffs, and he's averaging 27 a game, and he's guarding the other team's best player pretty well, if not, you know, unbelievably locked down well.
And he'll probably, well, we'll see what assignment he gets in the next round. Well, of course, we still don't know their opponent.
Yeah, you'd have to imagine if it is, I guess no matter who it is, he'll probably be in the point guard, I would think. Yeah, I mean, and LeBron is the other one. He actually has not been that efficient, especially in the Pistons series, but great net rating. He's setting up all of these three-pointers that the Cavs have just been draining. And you know, he, Klay, Draymond, they all have, you know, Andre Iguodala have like some of the best net ratings in the playoffs among the guys who actually play a decent number of minutes. And yeah, I think maybe if LeBron were a little more efficient, it might be him. But when you look at Klay's, maybe you would say a slightly more important defensive contribution than LeBron, you know, the Cavs have not defended incredibly well.
And they've played better competition, in my opinion.
The Cavs have played better
competition? No, the Warriors have.
That's an interesting question. And the Hawks were definitely better than the Blazers and Houston in the regular season. Detroit was probably better than Houston in the regular season. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think we may be underrating those teams just because the Cavs have made them look so bad.
That's possible.
And don't forget, the Pistons actually played them pretty closely. The Hawks maybe less so. So I don't know. I think when you consider what Klay has done with Curry being out and that they have done still pretty well without him in series that you might have guessed before. I mean, it's easy to go back and say, oh yeah, they would have been fine without Curry, but you know, they went basically, I guess, what was it, 4-2 without Curry, essentially?
Yeah, they went, 4-2.
And a lot of those games were pretty big blowouts, too, and he and Draymond were the biggest parts of that. And Draymond would probably be up there in that discussion, too, although not quite. His scoring, especially his getting to the free throw line, he's learning like a lot of kind of the dirty tricks of getting to the foul line, and the Warriors really needed a player like that because they weren't getting to that was their one weakness. They don't get to the foul line that much. Let's talk a little bit about what Portland was able to do in this series, though. And they have a very bright future. You asked Dame about that a little bit, and here's what he had to say.
Danny LaRue, The Athletic, this is for either one of you. You guys have had a really successful season, especially compared to expectations. What do you think that says and what you guys did this year says to the free agents and all the players that are, people that are around the league in terms of potentially coming to Portland?
I mean, I think it says that it's something. You know, we've built something that would be fun to be a part of. You know, we is not a selfish guy in our group. You know, we got here off working hard and being together. And, you know, since I've been in the league, I haven't been around a team that I've spent this much time around and had this much fun with from top to bottom. You know, even our rookies, you know, we got relationships with those guys like we've been knowing them. So, you know, I don't think that's common around the league, you know, where there's no jealousy and, you know, guys have friendships and, you know, we enjoy being around each other, you know, not trying to one-up each other. I think our culture that we've established this season is something that guys would want to be a part of.
Yeah, so based on this series, what do you think, you know, if you're selling Portland now to potential free agents, what can this series show about what this team can be?
They're well coached. They fight hard. They're very unselfish. I think that's the biggest credit to them, is that Lillard and McCollum, as much as they are scorers and talented scorers, they were completely willing to pass to the open guy to make the best play. I mean, Aminu and Harkless got lots of good opportunities. Sometimes they made them, sometimes they didn't. Plumlee is unselfish. I don't think he's their center of the future, but I do think he can be a nice piece for them, especially because he's on a rookie scale contract for another year. And the fact that they can add players at certain spots without really taking anything away. I mean, they have so little money on their books. And so if they can get a rim protecting center, or they can get a forward maybe that can do a couple other things, they could be an incredibly deep team. And so what this confirmed to me with this playoff run is that we should expect them to be in the playoffs next year and moving forward as long as they're healthy.
Yeah, we'll see what happens in the offseason. You know, I do think that Dame is a great leader, certainly, you know, and has done a great job helping with the culture. There have been a lot of great pieces on that. Kevin Artovitz wrote about it most recently for ESPN.com. But I think he probably took 4 or 5 pretty miserable shots per game early in the shot clock that were just step backs contested that he could stand to knock out of his game, and that this is a team that was scoring well enough that you didn't necessarily need to do that. But even, I mean, what Aminu was able to do in this series, hitting, being a pretty good defensive player, guarding everyone other than Steph Curry, playing as kind of a small ball four, his ability to shoot the ball, even drive on closeouts on occasion, I think that he, especially the other thing too for the Blazers, is I thought that this way of playing that they were forced into when Myers Leonard got hurt, and then they decided to just stop messing around with Noah Vonleh, was huge for them. Just playing with the one big man, they really became much more formidable once they started playing that way. They got their early jitters out of the way with the Clippers. Alan Crabb had a really nice series here, had a good end to the series with the Clippers after a really miserable start. They kind of figured out how just the ability as a team, I think, to go into the playoffs, know what it's like. When people talk about, oh, you know, playoff experience, blah, blah, blah. I don't know that it's so much like, oh, there's pressure, you're just not responding to it. It's more just that playoff basketball is different in the sense that there's so much more scouting. You are just become so familiar with teams. You have to find new wrinkles. The coach has to impart new ways to get it done every game. And I thought, while they struggled to execute on occasion in game four, I think they cleaned most of that up in this game, and they played extremely well. They should be proud of themselves.
They certainly should be, and what I like the most about their situation, and I mentioned this a little bit before, but I think it requires a little bit of emphasis, and we'll talk about it a little bit tomorrow, is they have all of their most important players on the books, so they can. They got Al-Farouq Aminu. He has three more years.
For cheap,
for cheap. He has three more years. I think it's about $22 million because it's a descending contract. Ed Davis has two more years, also descending. Lillard is signed. He'll probably get Rose ruled, but that only goes to 27.5 because of the agreement they made. So,
Rather than 30%.
Rather than
30. Salary cap,
And so you have all these guys on reasonable contracts. Of course, CJ is going to get paid eventually, but if Paul Allen is willing to spend on this team, and he should be. You know, he should walk away from this playoff saying, okay, you know, if we can get an expensive guy who's good this year, and you just push a couple of the guys in their front court down a little bit, they're going to be awesome.
Yeah, and they also saved a crap load of money this year, too, with making that trade for Varejao barely being at the minimum salary. I think they're still pretty below the cap even as of now. Let's talk a little bit more about this game in particular. One thing that I thought Portland did that a lot of teams can learn from against Golden State and just in general is they did a great job of pushing the ball in crunch time. And part of that was because they're down, but they had that mentality. And even one of your favorites, running off of makes, they did a great job of that. CJ McCollum got, you know, an and one on Curry late. He was able to make Curry fall on his ass and pull up from the elbow in transition as well. They got some very nice shots and were able they got another shot too where they got a quick offensive rebound and McCollum hit a three. He had a great, great fourth quarter and was definitely had the crowd pretty nervous. So that's one thing that I thought you was strategic here that I found interesting.
Yeah, and I mean just the fact that it felt like all of their threes were open, which is crazy against a Warriors team that does not do that. The Warriors particularly, I talked about this with Seth Partnow on Real GM Radio, he brought up the point that the Warriors are very good about not giving up catch and shoot threes, and Portland got a metric ton of them in this series.
Yeah, and especially in this game, the Warriors were a little bit off. Their communication was not great. There were, you know, a couple of just small pick and rolls where they just didn't execute the switch, weren't able to communicate. A lot of times, you know, there was over-helping on the pick and roll. I mean, they're just getting corner threes off the backside of the pick and roll or wing threes off the backside of the pick and roll over and over again. Guys like Harkless and Aminu were hitting their shots, obviously. So was CJ. But this is also really the first good. I mean, they've played some good offenses in the playoffs, but this is the first one that actually is good because they moved the ball. You know, Cleveland last year, their strategy was to pound the ball into the ground with LeBron. The Houston that they played twice, you know, it's just throw it to Harden and hope that he can create something for everyone else. You know, Golden State is perfectly set up to deal with that. Memphis wasn't really any good either. You know, New Orleans, whatever, they were decent, but, you know, not like an elite offense that you think about. And so this is really, I think, the first team they've played that has challenged them in this way. And they had some good moments of defense and they had some that, you know, were not really so good. Any other kind of smaller things that you noted about this game?
Steve Kerr continues to drive both of us insane with his rotations. And that...
Yeah, you know, he used to be so good with this stuff. And especially like in the final, I thought really the rotations that he had in the finals last year were just so incredible once they, in those last three games, once they went to starting the death lineup, playing Azili, not playing Poget, like he was just on fire with his rotations. And you know, this, I think he just has kind of gotten a little too into like this whole, hey, everyone's a contributor and we're all strength in numbers. And, you know, I'm going to push all these different buttons and like this guy's going to come through for us. You know, and maybe that's even the result of kind of this magical season where he feels that stuff is working, but in reality, it's like his main guys bailing out some of the weaker players on the roster.
Draymond Green covering for Anderson Varejao's defensive disasters in this game was insane. Like, Draymond Green was basically guarding two guys at once for like a 5-minute stretch.
Yeah, and the other thing that really is kind of bothered me is just they have like this crazy short leash for Festus Ezeli. Like, there's the two times that he has kind of had some offensive struggles just catching the ball and finishing was, I want to say it was game three against Houston, either game three or game four against Houston, where he then didn't play for a while. And then, you know, he played it in game two a fair amount, but, you know, why can't he just be the backup center and you're just going to play Azili and Bogut and then Green to close out each half instead of necessarily having to go with Spates as much as they have? Like, Spates, you know, hit some threes, but he also is just gets killed in pick and roll defense every time, and they just go right at him to Portland's credit whenever he's in the game there. So, and Azili struggled to catch the ball, but it's like his defense was still amazing at the start of the third quarter after Bogut went out, and then they just put in Varejao for him, and I was like, oh yeah, I get it that he fumbled a couple of plays, but he's been doing a ton of great things. Like, one of the plays that he fumbled was his own offensive rebound that he just created for himself anyway. So, like, you know, you can't penalize him for that. So I don't know. I was a little distressed by that. And I think if they're, depending on who they're going against, a lot of Spates and a lot of Varejao, especially if this Bogut groin injury ends up being significant, could come back to bite them. You know, we'll see. This team's margin for error with some of their health issues recently is a lot lower than it was at times during the regular season, though.
You talked about the, you know, how to balance center minutes. I also think that they need to be ready to do a lot more Draymond at center. I would be pushing for 20 to 25 minutes a game in the games that matter, because it is a lineup that none of the remaining teams that they face have a counter for. So you go to that, you rely on it more heavily, and then you have enough wing depth now. You have to actually make it work.
Down the stretch, there were some pretty interesting strategic machinations. They did go to the death lineup, although eventually, actually, for the very end of the game, it was Livingston. Stotts tried to stay with Ed Davis, and Curry blew past him for a layup, blew past him for a little dump off to Green, and then hit a three over him. And so then, at the very end, on an offensive possession, they went to Harkless. And Harkless, you know, he wasn't guarding him, but then they switched Aminu onto him, and that's when he hit that crazy three. So that was, but, you know, the Warriors weren't able to stop him on the other end with Draymond Green, you know, being a little hobbled. I also thought that Portland, they got that three-shot foul from Lillard when they were, I think, down four after Steph had hit a couple of free throws. And Lillard hits the first two, and then he hit the third, and Stott subbed in Harkless for McCollum, who had five fouls, and with specific instructions, you have to deny Curry. Harkless tried to hold Curry. That was a good call. You couldn't really see it on the broadcast, but we actually could see it from where it was that Harkless was holding Curry's jersey as he tried to break free on that play that where a foul was called. But considering that you have Steph and Clay on the other team and they're so good at getting it to those guys late, I might have considered just missing that last free throw intentionally. And they did not, with 10 seconds left, they did not think of that. Though I still think that is something that, especially if you practice it, just, you know, 10 minutes at the start of the season or something to just practice getting intentionally missed free throws, you could actually, like, be pretty effective in those situations. More, a better chance of that than Steph missing a free throw and you getting to actually get a chance to tie, I think.
Especially when you're probably going to give the other team an opportunity to foul, because I think Portland only had one timeout left, so if you advance the ball, then you can take that away from them too.
Yeah, and also in a scramble situation, I think you could probably score pretty quickly. And, I mean, what are your chances, you think? I think, like, the normal free throw offensive rebound percentage is maybe, like, 10%. But if you consider, number one, you can put in your absolute best rebounders. Number two, you should be able to miss it in a way that you know exactly where it is going. Like, you could do something like even have the guy on one block almost screen for the guy on the other block, and the guy boxing him out to sort of confuse the defense. You'd have guys crashing in hard. You know, you could probably get that free throw offensive rebound rate up to like 20 or 25% in that situation. And that's a much, and then, you know, maybe you can score off that. You got a much better chance that 20 or 25% is a much better chance than, you know, Steph missing a free throw or two.
Agreed. We're on the same boat. Oh, actually, there's one other thing I wanted to bring up that could become an issue very soon. Draymond Green got his fourth technical foul in this game. And seven is a one-game suspension mandatory. He could get there.
Yeah, or he could also just get a lot more sane. that could also, yeah, I mean, the play where he, and he got lucky that, you know, when he was in, like, raising his arms up to, like, complain again about a call, which was a little dubious, he, like, slammed his hand accidentally into Ken Mowers and, like, caused him to, like, start bleeding or something, which is pretty bad. Oh, the other thing, too, is that Draymond was at center, got his fifth foul with 5:35 remaining, And Kerr did not take him out and did not go away from the death lineup. That was the right call. Just with 5 minutes left, you just got to stick with the guy at that point. And, you know, if they had taken him out or gone to a different lineup, you know, who knows whether they win the game or not.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because there were moments that there were kind of like Portland missed two free throws in the last 2 minutes. Things like that that you didn't necessarily think because the Warriors were ahead so much late, but those ended up being close to the margin.
Yeah, Ed Davis and more unlikely, McCollum did. Let's get to Toronto and Miami, but first, a message from Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. That's our URL, so you go through there to let them know that you came from us. And the reason you want to check them out is because they are the largest independent automated investing service out there. And you may have been hearing about them in TechCrunch or the Wall Street Journal. And the reason why is because it just makes it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. It's built on smarter, cutting-edge technology to bring you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services because of the fact that it's automated. So more than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms, and they have a beautiful user interface. This is the perfect time to get started with them and in saving for your retirement or other financial goals because, of course, Dunton listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. You can learn how, again, at that betterment.com/capspace URL. You remember capspace. That's what we talk about all the time on the show. That is the code in one way or another for all the sponsors. Betterment.com/capspace, investing made better. This game wasn't unwatchable.
It wasn't.
All right, we're done here. Should we call it quits until tomorrow?
Well, so one thing I thought was interesting, as much as we've maligned them in other games, Toronto not only had more assists than Miami in this game, they also had more secondary assists.
Yeah, they were moving the ball a little bit more. They had actually some plays where they were able to get guys open. But really, to me, when Miami lost this game was in the first like 5 minutes of the game when they went down 9-0. And that was a 3-10 stretch in which Amari Stoudemire, the starting center, played, and he had 0 points, was -9 during that period, and was directly responsible for giving up a couple of buckets. And as our boy Kevin Pelton noted, he has played 31 minutes in the series, and the Heat are -20 in that span. It was pretty much lunacy at this point, given how Stoudemire has played in the playoffs, for him to be starting against the best lineup for the other team. And of course, McRoberts basically played at center the rest of the time until they went down the stretch to the unit with Winslow at center. And the reason they had to do that was that this game was just a massive, and this series really has become a massive war of attrition.
Yeah, I mean, so you had the centers go out in the same game, and then in this one, of course, the positional lines get crossed a little bit, but both of their small forwards went out, Luol Deng, and both with wrist injuries, actually. Luol Deng and Damari Carroll both went out, and when we saw it, my initial reaction was that Carroll's was worse, but we don't know all the severity yet, but it sounds like it might actually be Deng's.
The one thing probably that I believe needs reform in the NBA more than anything else, and we talk about a lot of these things, it's a great league. The league has done a great job of improving the game, improving the rules. Allowing zone defense was just so massive in changing the way things are. We've talked about that on the show, how that forced teams to, you know, basically not allow you to play a guy who was terrible on offense anymore, because then you could just not guard that guy. So that made teams have to play more offense and really and move the ball more and really kind of speed up the game and make it more of a skill game. And also cutting down a contact in the perimeter, although that now is kind of, the enforcement of that has gotten kind of lax. So I think, you know, the league does a great job overall. I love it. There's a reason this is my career. The biggest thing I think needs to be changed is the charge rule. And I mean, despite the fact that just jumping in front of someone and falling down is a lot more boring than an awesome confrontation at the rim or a dunk, it also just leads to injuries.
It's incredibly unsafe.
And it's one thing when, you know, at the high school level, you don't have guys who are flying through the air and going up to try and dunk on somebody, or, you know, taking off from the dotted line with that level of athleticism. When that's happening and you have people, a rule that encourages you to just jump in front of someone who is in the air and essentially, I mean, there's just, you're undercutting them. That's what you are doing. The rule just needs to be changed. There's a player safety issue. Durant, basically, I think could have had his season ruined last year with Mo's Bates trying to take a charge on him, undercutting him, causing him to sprain his ankle. Jabari Parker tore his ACL, someone trying to avoid a charge that someone was took on him. Carroll may have broken his wrist, or at least, you know, he was immediately ruled out. We don't know how bad the injury is. He's going to get an MRI. It really was just, and there have been a host of other injuries too that happened due to attempts to take charges. I think the way to fix that, and we'll probably do a whole episode on this at some point. I always say that, but at some point it'll have to happen. I think the way to fix it is just to expand the charge circle out further. So you're at the point where people who you just, it's almost impossible to take a charge on someone who is driving to the basket and is already in the air. And that way you can just avoid having these injuries. And that's not the type of play that people want to see anyway. You know, if someone's in the air already, like, then you should just be jumping to try and block the shot or at least, you know, do verticality and contest. And I think that would really help the league. And then the other thing is one of your pet issues, as well as mine, the play that Dane got injured on was the cameras.
They serve no purpose that is essential. And players, it's not only that players get hurt, it's that they avoid him. Leandro Barbosa, on a drive, had to do this little, basically, hopscotch around the photographer. And there isn't a reason for them to be there for what you're getting from it. And these players are moving so quickly. This is another one of those things that's different at this level versus any other level, where they are becomes an issue all the time. If you watch a game, especially if you watch it in person, you'll see a couple of times, almost every single game, you'll see a player navigate that, and they shouldn't have to be even thinking about it, much less having to actually change their footing.
Yeah, I agree with you. They at least have opened up those escape lanes directly on the side of the basket, but they're still too close. Just move them out further to the left or right or further back, or have some sort of an automated control just like they have on top of the basket. There's no reason at this point that you can't just do that behind the basket as well, a little bit further back. They can zoom in. It's really just inexcusable and another kind of player health injury, and we see injuries from that every single year. You know, Chris Paul has had his whole career potentially ruined by something like that. Was never the same after he tore his meniscus going into the cameras. All right, let's talk a little bit more about the game, though. That's a little bit too morose.
Bismack Biyombo, let's go there.
Yeah, Bismack Biyombo, who famously did not play down the stretch in Game 4 when the Heat went to their small lineup. Dwayne Casey, to his credit at least, he'll do some, like, things that maybe don't make much sense at first, but he'll adjust eventually, and he actually was playing both Biyombo and Patterson. Patterson really, once Carroll went out, is kind of their only option to match up with Joe Johnson, who's too strong for basically anyone else that they're going to be playing. And it worked. You know, Biyombo was getting on the offensive glass. He drew some loose ball fouls. He was protecting the rim. They owned the glass in this game. And he was great. Like, Biyombo has looked every bit the part of a starting center since Valanciunas went down.
And one of my favorite things that the NBA has done recently in terms of stats is that now it is hustle stats, what they're calling it, are publicly available on stats.nba. And in this game, Miami had 4 credited screen assists. So that's where you set a screen that directly leads to a basket. Miami had 4. Bismack Biyombo had 8.
Yeah, he's been up there in pretty much all the games. Now, part of that is because all they ever do is run high pick and roll. But the other part is he obliterates dudes on these screens. And now you would say that maybe the antidote to that for if he's on another team, just thinking about him kind of as a free agent, is when he sets the screen, you can trap because he's not going to do anything with it on a short roll. But, you know, there's other ways to deal with that. You can short the pick and roll and get it to him right under the basket too. And when we say short the pick and roll, that's different than a short roll. Shorting it is someone comes up from another area anticipating the trap, so he can kind of be an outlet, and then you have a better passing angle to that guy who initially set the screen rolling to the basket. That's what we mean when we talk about that. But yeah, I thought Biyombo was great. They did not have an answer for him anymore because it was McRoberts and it was Amare and it was, you know, Justice Winslow, who did everything he could. But Justice is not a good enough offensive player right now, and you can just get away with guarding him with Biyombo. And it does kind of put into stark relief like how bad it was to not have him out there, because they just got killed so badly in all the areas that Biyombo could have helped in Game 4. And we could bless our hearts that this series would be over by now. But at least, you know, they adjusted, and he was a huge difference maker for a Heat team that just doesn't have any size anymore.
And the other big positive for the Toronto Raptors was DeMar DeRozan.
Yeah, I went back and watched all of his points. He was able to get out in transition for a couple of buckets, and overall, his line looked fantastic. He was 11 out of 22 from the field, 11 of 11 from the free throw line, only one turnover, which is one thing that is a little underrated about him, is he doesn't turn it over that much, and of course, a mere 2 assists. But so 34 points on 27 shooting possessions, Plus five seems like very good. But if you really, this is one of those times where the box score is deceivingly good, because the 11-11 from the free throw line, I think six of those were just kind of late fouls where the Heat were trying to get come back that, you know, he didn't really do anything to earn. And then the other five of his free throws, one was just an and one that he made the shot, but it was just a, kind of a dumb foul on a jump shot. Another one was a fadeaway by Tyler Johnson, where you couldn't really tell, they didn't show a replay of whether he hit him on the wrist or not, but not, you know, a good shot that it's like, all right, we had to foul this guy. And then another one was late clock, Wade just doing a dumb reach in on him, you know, late, which, you know, both of those fouls were massive for the Heat, who actually, you know, got back within one when they got their own kind of weird foul call on a Wade jumper that was super late from, I think, Tony Brothers. But, and so if you consider then those two shots that he got fouled on, if those just become misses in the Heat, you know, the Heat just avoid committing a dumb foul, then, you know, he, and you take out the six shots that he made just from getting fouled late, and then he's got, you know, basically like 23 points on 24 shooting possessions or something like that. So it would, it was not some amazing breakout performance. He was getting slightly better shots on his mid-range looks. He got into the paint for 6 out of 10 of his shots, shot 6 out of 10 from there. Still was 4 of 11 from mid-range. So he got a little bit closer, a little bit less contested on some of the looks, but I'm not willing to conclude that, like, everything's all fixed with him now.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of the same with Kyle Lowry, but the difference with Lowry is that it's pretty definitive that the Raptors are so much better with him on the floor.
Yeah, and he only had 6 assists. He hit a ridiculous shot when they were up 3, basically a carbon copy of that ISO that he missed, I want to say, in game 1. No, I'm sorry, game 2 it was, when we were just criticizing the play. Game 1 was the crazy...
half-quarter.
The crazy half-court shot, yeah. But just a fadeaway 28-footer over Josh Richardson, just, you know, 25% shot happened to go down for him. He at least was 4 of 9 on threes, although 9 out of 25 overall, 25 points for Lowry.
And he was a plus 25 in this game?
Yeah, which is, and really the only time that the Heat were able to get back into it was when he was off the floor at the end of the first quarter. And then I think also the end of the second quarter, they had him out and it was like the DeRozan show and he was just like kicking it away and taking bad shots during that period.
So, of course, we don't know what the injury situations are going to be, but can Miami get back into this?
Yeah, dang, x-rays on his wrist were inconclusive.
Concerning.
Yeah, he injured it in the second quarter. Then it swelled up to the point where he was unable to play in the third quarter. He also, you'll recall, went back when he was with the Bulls. Do you recall what wrist it is that he injured?
No.
But, you know, he had the same issue, a wrist issue with the Bulls, and he actually never had the surgery that he was needed. He just played through it. I want to say that was in 2011-12. He just played through it and then just rehabbed it and never really had the surgery. So if he can't go, they're big men. They're just not getting anything from them at this point. Wade, what he was doing was unbelievable throughout the series, but you can't just count on quite that level from him at age 34 every single night. I mean, he's going to have to score 30 a night for them. I think especially with Biombo out there, they're really good on defense now. Biombo is great in the pick and roll against these guys. And Dragic hasn't been able to really get going since early in the series. I predict that Toronto will win the next game, especially now if they're going to stick with Biombo down the stretch. And I thought that, you know, once the two centers went down that they just had such an advantage. I expect them to win game 6. I think, you know, maybe if Deng plays and Damari Carroll doesn't, that could change. But Spo is just running out of options, running out of bodies at this point.
I just think there's a distinct chance that Wade has one of those, like, 35-point games to bring them back to a game 7. But it's hard for me to imagine Miami winning the series at the bare minimum.
Yeah, although Toronto at home in a game 7 is for the fourth time in their last four series, third time in their last four series would be very interesting. One thing that I found interesting about the end, other than how often that I've been using the word interesting, it's been a long day for us. But in any event, Miami with Winslow at center was just switching everything down the end. And the Raptors actually probably had more movement and plays down the end of the game than they normally do. But it didn't do them any good because Miami was just switching everything. Like, this would have been the time to just get their ISO on whoever the weakest defender was, Joe Johnson, a lot of the time. And whenever they were able to actually get Johnson on someone, like Corey Joseph had a sweet reverse layup on him, then they're able to score a lot of those times. But instead, they were kind of just running stuff. At one point, you know, DeRozan actually had Johnson on him, and Biombo came up to set a screen to put Winslow onto DeRozan, which is actually a much better matchup for Miami. And I think I probably actually would have just started with Winslow on DeRozan and had Johnson on Biombo, which they did a couple of times. So that was, I think Toronto could be a little bit better prepared to just go do their iso ball in the most favorable possible conditions. That's one of the things that's killed me about them in their series, is like, even when they do the iso, it always seems to be like against some great defender on the Heat, when you could at least do something to get that guy off of them. So that was one thing. And then the other I thought found of note was that I think one of Toronto's problems when they run the clock down so much is that they don't really have a system, right? It's always just a play. And a lot of the times they are wasting a bunch of time just getting everybody into the perfect position that they have to be in to start this set play that doesn't have a ton of options in it. And a team like the Warriors, they don't call plays a lot of the times, right? They have just a base offense. They have an understanding of what guys are going to do, you know, whether it's going to be a DHO or a pick and roll or whatever that you can get, whether it's back cuts, getting the ball into the post. They just have a flow to them that a team like the Raptors doesn't. And so it's just kind of station to station play as opposed to any kind of improvisation, but within a framework that people really understand. And so that's why it seems like they waste so much time setting up the offense a lot of times. And they had a couple of those late where it's just kind of Lowry standing up there dribbling while everyone just runs into position. And then by the time everyone gets started, there's eight on the shot clock.
And it is an important distinction to make that they do that. And, you know, the Warriors do have guys that are better suited to that kind of an offense. But my instinct is that asking a little bit more of guys and encouraging them to be more kind of assertive in the sense of, you know, figuring out what's best for that situation, I think that players can respond to that and do well with it. That's not to say that they'll make the right decision every time, but I think they'll respond.
All right, that'll do it for today. You got anything to plug before we depart?
Yes, I recorded Real GM Radio with Seth Partnow, which was really fun. We went through some playoff stuff and a lot of other discussions. And then my player-by-player analysis for Warriors Blazers game 5 should be up by the time people listen to this on The Athletic, and I will write another piece tomorrow morning.
All right, sounds good. We'll be back tomorrow talking Spurs Thunder, massive game 6, and that, you know, could really change a lot of things around the league depending on what ends up happening. You know, it could be Tim Duncan's last game ever tomorrow night. You know, Manu Ginobili's two all-time great guys. If the Thunder, I mean, they're not out of the woods yet. You know, if they lose tomorrow, they still could be pretty big underdogs in a game 7 on the road. You know, everyone knows what the statistics are. 80% of home team win game 7, even though there's some selection bias there, because, you know, the home team is usually the better team. It's still, those are daunting odds. So they definitely need to win tomorrow as well. And then we'll also talk about the Blazers offseason. I'm pretty excited for their offseason. They have all this cap space, and we're going to get really deep into, especially if you're a new listener, you haven't been around for one of the cap space, offseason type of episodes. We'll talk about all their cap space, potential free agents, really get deep into that. So looking forward to getting back to the spreadsheets, but in a fun way.
It's always in a fun way.
All right, that'll do it for tonight. We will talk to you all next time. Don't forget, betterment.com/capspace if you want to check out their automated lower cost investing services and support the pod as well. Talk to you tomorrow.